The DNR commissioner is the administrative and the executive head of the Department of Natural Resources. He has authority over public lands, waters, state parks, forests, timber, mineral resources, recreational trails, and wildlife of the state, and their use, sale, leasing, and other disposition.
Is that all?
Yeah, just a few things to do. Governor Mark Dayton appointed Tom Landwehr as DNR commissioner, and he is back with us in our studios. Tom, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Did you know you had all those duties?
I try not to think about that because it gets a little overwhelming at times.
Well, I wonder if we can start the conversation today with kind of the basics of public land, why we have public lands, why they sometimes change hands, and maybe move into what was going on in the legislature this year.
Okay, sure. Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. You know, when you live in Grand Rapids, you recognize there's a lot of state land around, and it looks like state forest for the most part up here. But the history of state lands in Minnesota goes way back to statehood. Back in 1858, the federal government deeded to the state 8 million acres for school trusts, and that was land that the state was given in order to generate revenue to create a K-12 education system. We've actually sold off 5.5 million acres of that original aid, so we have 2.5 million acres of school trust land left. But in northern Minnesota, much of what we have is actually land that nobody else wants. So you get a little further west, and we have what we call consolidated conservation lands. Those were lands that the counties had tried to ditch to turn them into arable farmland. Well, the ditches failed. You know, it's that big bog stuff. And the counties, the landowners that settled that could not pay their taxes. The counties could not pay the bonds. The counties were on the verge of going belly up. The state assumed all those lands and then took them from the county and made the counties whole. So we got a bunch of swamp lands, essentially, too, that came that way. And there's a couple other smaller ways that the state came to own land. But by and large, what we have, much of it is just stuff that nobody else wanted and nobody's going to pay taxes on. Not completely. Of course, we have some really good state forest land, and we manage timber on that, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. And more recently, since about the 50s, we've actually been buying some land. So in 1951, the state started a Save the Wetlands program. It's now called our Wildlife Management Area program. We started buying lands for public recreation and for wildlife management. So the state now owns about 5.5 million acres of land, and makes the state a very large landowner. That does not count the land that's managed for the counties. There's county tax forfeit land, and certainly Itasca County has some of that. Some of the other northern counties do, and does not count federal land. So think of the state, the National Forest or Voyageurs National Park, things like that. So a number of different types of public land, but for the most part, the state owns land to manage for economic development. So think state forests and mining, for wildlife management and production, so think wildlife management areas, or for near rare natural features, so like our large peatlands that we manage because they're a very, very rare natural resource.
Okay, we've had forest products up here for as long as people have been up here. How does the state, you know, manage the forests? You need to do it for commercial purposes, but you also have to do it in an ecologically responsible way, I guess. So how would you describe that?
So one of the primary reasons for the state to actually acquire land or maintain land for forestry is really to provide a safety net for the forest products industry. It was intended that the state should own land such that there would be timber available for human uses, much the same for the national forest, incidentally. But purposes for land management have evolved over time. You know, obviously the legislature recognized that people recreate a lot in these timberlands, especially up here. You'll know that in November when, you know, all you can see is orange dots drifting through the trees. And so we have over time, both by virtue of state law as well as policy, adopted a sustainable harvest approach. And as you know, all of our forests are now what we call dual certified for timber production. That means that they are certified as sustainable and following certain best management practices. And by virtue of that, we get a seal of approval from Forest Stewardship Council and the Sustainable Forestry Initiative. That makes it a much more valuable product for the companies that buy trees, whether it's Blandin or Potlatch or whoever, because that marker then goes to the retail market. And so Staples, the company, wants certified paper products. Now they can get that because it starts right here with the raw material that the state is producing, these certified managed forests.
We still have plenty of harvesting going on. I mean, it's obvious the way you've implied the product use. And I've noticed over the last 30 years a change, especially starting in the late 80s and maybe through the 90s, a change in management. I know on the private lands here at Bland and Paper, they've shifted a lot of their timber management practices, and it seems like the state and the privates are pretty much on the same page in terms of the way they manage the forest now.
You know, Blandon is really sort of cutting edge. You know, they're as a company, obviously, they're able to move much more quickly in implementing new things. They don't have to, you know, go get approval from the legislature or anything like that. And Cheryl Adams, who, you know, I've known for years, their forester, is just cutting edge forester. They manage by community type, so they look at what the best type of timber ought to be on any particular parcel of land, and that's how they manage it. We're working that way as well. We have gone through a long process to identify sort of ecological units in the whole state forest system, such that we can identify, again, the most productive type of timber to grow on any particular tract. But it has changed a lot. I think forestry is always evolving. You know, it used to be, you think back, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was just slash and burn. You just take it and leave nothing behind. Then I think we got into, in the mid-1900s to
tree farming, kind of.
Tree farming and large clear cuts. And now when you look at our clear cuts, they're smaller. Now we use selective harvest. Some of the equipment that's used is very, very precise. You can go in and just take particular trees out of forest and so on. So it has evolved over time, and now we take into consideration rare species. We take into consideration rare communities and recreation and all kinds of other things.
And you get into controversies. I remember we had a controversy over bats. Remember bat habitat?
That's right,
and controlling the harvest at the right time of the year so the bat reproduction would be okay in parts of northern Minnesota.
And still a philosophy we're managing under northern long-eared bat is a bat that's in decline because of that white nose syndrome. So we try to leave, trees that we think are suitable for nesting.
So there's a little tiny part of public lands called scientific and natural areas. What are they?
So that goes to the approach I mentioned, that we protect really rare natural resources. So you think of the state of Minnesota, we had a lot of fairly unique types of communities that you may not find anywhere else. The best example I can give is down in southeast Minnesota. There's a type of a flower, a very small orchid that grows nowhere else but in southeast Minnesota. And so if you lose that, its genetics are gone from the globe forever. We have a number of other similar types of habitats. So you think of the prairie bush clover, you think of some of the northern peatlands, they are not found virtually anywhere else. And so as we face a growing population, as we face development, many of these lands are threatened. And so we have a program that was created, I think, back in the 80s, the Scientific and Natural Area Program, where our biologists go out and identify the best examples of that type of community and work with private landowners to protect that somehow, either by easement or by covenant or by purchase. And so we have, it's a pretty small program relative to others, but it really protects some of the most important places. Think of it as the Noah's Ark of ecosystem protection in Minnesota.
I think there's an island in Pacagma, Heidi.
It's right across from where I live.
Is that right?
Yes. Which makes me very happy because I get that view. But I always kind of wonder will that always be a scientific natural area?
So almost all of our designations are, they're statutory designations, so they're set up in law that says here's what this type of land is, here's a process you go to protect it. Very, very rarely do we ever undesignate or change a designation of a particular piece of land, and a number of reasons for that. But as long as that area continues to support, maintain the community for which it was originally established, it'll stay that way.
Are all natural waters and streams publicly owned?
In Minnesota, when you think of the U.S., we're under a management philosophy of water that we call Eastern Water Law. It's not very unique versus Western Water Law. Western Water Law says that the person whose land the water is on owns the water. Hmm. Very different from Minnesota. In Minnesota, all water, both surface and groundwater, is considered public water. So even, and it certainly doesn't extend to puddles or things like that. I don't know exactly where the demarcation is, but virtually any body of water that you can float a boat in is considered a public water, and as long as you have a legal access to it, you can use the surface of the water. So it's a very populist approach to water management, and I think we benefit immensely by virtue of that.
Okay, so what's the relationship? I've heard that the PCA has jurisdiction over water quality.
Correct.
Is that true?
Right.
And that's out of DNR.
And I think it's by, you know, it looks kind of happenstance, but I think it's by design, actually. The legislature has assigned different responsibilities for water to different agencies, so it doesn't all kind of rest in one. So you think Department of Health, they actually have to license any well that goes into the ground. So if you want to sink a well for your house, you have to get a permit from the Department of Health, because we don't want people pumping up water that's got, you know, arsenic or radon or whatever in it. And DNR is responsible for water quantity. So if you are going to take more than 1 million gallons a year from the ground, for instance, you have to get a permit from DNR. Similar for surface water appropriations, you know, the plant, power plant right here, Bannon, if they're going to take water for cooling, they have to get a permit from DNR. But the water quality is a PCA responsibility, and that sort of delegated to PCA from the Environmental Protection Agency, because much of our backbone of our water quality laws are the Clean Water Act of 1972, and so that flows through to PCA. PCA implements, they set standards, and then they follow through, especially with municipalities, think of wastewater treatment and things like that, to make sure that dirty water is not dumped into public waters.
We are talking with Minnesota DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr. He's in the studios with us this morning. So tell me a little bit how the public lands might have come up in the Minnesota legislature. How did it turn out to your liking, or what was it like?
You know, it was an interesting year at the Capitol. Public lands, there's always been this sort of tension around public lands, because there's some people that believe that, you know, when the state or the federal government owns land, it comes, quote unquote, comes off the tax rolls. And that's certainly true. When the state owns land, we don't pay property taxes in the traditional sense. But there is a provision in state law that we call payment in lieu of taxes, or PILT. So the state reimburses pays to the counties in which there is state land a certain dollar amount, depending on the type of the land. And so, for instance, school trust land, $1.50 per acre is paid to each county that has school trust land for to compensate for the loss of tax revenue they might get. And the amount differs depending on the type of land. So, for instance, if we acquire a wildlife management area, we actually pay 0.75% of the purchase price per year. So if you got a $100,000 piece of property, we pay $750. And when you look at that payment rate, it actually compares quite favorably with the tax payment. So the tension has always been this notion that if the state owns it, A, it's not available for development, B, it's putting a strain on tax rolls, and therefore, in some people's minds, we should be selling that state land. And that kind of came to a head, not perhaps quite as blatant as that, but concern in some areas, especially in northern Minnesota, that the state owns too much land. We should not be buying any more land. We ought to, in fact, be selling it. And I think it was, you know, it's just too simplistic of an argument. It failed to acknowledge that, you know, we support 30% of the timber, the products industry. We support, you know, much of the mining industry in Minnesota. Think of the public recreation that comes off of that. As those values started to rise up in the face of that argument, I think people started to realize, you know, wait a minute, maybe it's not just so black and white as, you know, public land is bad and private land is good. Mm-hmm. And so some of these efforts to reduce the ability of the department to acquire land ultimately faded away. And I think the public was heard. Public said, you know, we want those forests to be protected for forest management. In fact, we hear that all the time for the forest products industry, as private landowners reduce their willingness to sell timber, the state lands, the county lands, the federal lands become more important. Again, the school trust owns a number of acres that are being mined right now for iron ore and some of the potential copper nickel. A school trust land that a couple of years ago put $60 million into the school trust fund by virtue of the state ownership. And you know, hunting, for example, is a $700 million industry in Minnesota.
I was going to say, I know people that come to Minnesota to hunt because we have so much public land, and I have some friends that go, but they have to have a private landowner in South Dakota or North Dakota if they want to hunt in those states.
It's a phenomenal heritage for us. And think of the Ruffed Grouse Society's annual hunt. It is almost exclusively on public land, and mm-hmm. and you know,
people
much of that 700
all over North America for that too.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think the last time we had you in, Tom, it was right before opening fishing.
Yeah.
Big question for you. Have you been able to fish at all this summer?
A little bit, especially early in the summer. I haven't gotten out much lately, but I still hope to get out a couple more times before the hunting season starts.
Fall fishing is always nice.
It is. You know, for me, once the state fair comes around and all of a sudden it's fall, the shotgun comes out, the fishing rod goes away, and I, you know, wait till ice fishing season to get back out again.
Go ahead, Heidi.
I was going to say, it comes up a lot in the headlines that we see around the state about aquatic invasive species. What can you tell us on that front?
You know, I think we often hear the next lake that's been put on the list, you know, and it all looks doom and gloom. I would say the good side of that is that we collectively, we, the counties, the lake associations, the department, have done a pretty darn good job of slowing the spread. So the fact that you're only hearing one or two or three lakes a year is an indication that we're doing a pretty good job, because we have 800,000 registered boats in the state. We have 1,500 state public water accesses. We estimated one year there are 5 million boat launchings a year. And if we're only seeing a handful of lakes, it means we're doing a pretty good job of slowing the spread. Now, slowing the spread doesn't mean we're keeping it out or eliminating it. So we know that that's not the best long-term approach. And the glimmer of light there is that the University of Minnesota has what they call a Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center, MASRC. And they are looking for ways to control aquatic invasive species. So zebra mussels, curly leaf pondweed, starry stonewort.
Yeah, we've had this starry stonewort lately, and that was a new one for me a couple of years ago, and it sounds really aggressive.
And really awful. And you know, what we don't know is, because people don't recognize it very easily, is how long has it been there? You know, yeah. It could have been there for, you know, a decade, and we wouldn't even know it because people
now,
don't
recognize it. Now, would that be, it grows in deep water, I think, or deep, would that be, could that easily be transferred by boats?
Oh, absolutely.
Easy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You bet.
Okay.
It's actually an algae.
I've never seen it. So
but it looks like it's filamentous, so it looks like a weed.
Okay.
It looks like Kara is one of the aquatic native species we talk about. It looks a lot like that, which is why for many years it hadn't been identified. And so you pull your boat out, you see a couple of strands of weeds hanging off your motor, your trailer, you don't think much of it. Well, that could be the invasive species. And so that's why the state law says you have to stop, pull everything off your trailer, your boat, pull the drain plug, you know, make sure your live well is empty, and just leave everything at the lake that, you know, you took out of the lake.
Hey, I want to put in a plug for DNR website. I use it a lot. It's easy mm-hmm. to use. If I want to make a reservation for camping, or if I want to learn how to camp or fish, there's all these tips there. And I also go there for your press releases. And last week, I believe there was a press release about inviting legacy grants.
Right.
And I think up north, I think a lot of people would like to know more about what are the legacy grants, how do they work, and what kind of projects
sure.
legacy grants would fund?
So, well, first, let me go back, Scott. Our website is mndnr.gov.
Okay.
And so, absolutely, it's a great place to get a lot of information about natural resources. When the legacy fund was created, legacy amendment was passed in 2008, there were four different buckets, and one of those was what we call the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and that was for expenditures on activities to protect what's the language specifically? It's protect, enhance, restore prairies, wetlands, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. So it really is oriented towards kind of wildlife habitat. And a lot of really great projects have been done under that. So, for instance, the big Blandon easement was paid for with that. It was a $45 million project. A lot of smaller parcels.
Now, that's 190,000 acres of forest
exactly.
put into a conservation easement.
Exactly.
Which means it's managed in a certain way, sustainable way.
Right? It has. There were really four big components of that. One is that it can't be developed, mm-hmm. so that will stay as forest. Two is that it has to be managed sustainably, mm-hmm. so it has to meet those same protocols we would talk about for certification. Three is it's open for public recreation, which is perhaps the biggest thing. And four is that it can't be subdivided more than a handful of times, so it will always be big block. But that's the type of a project that the Outdoor Heritage Fund was intended to do, you know, is enhance those outdoor habitat types of things. And one of the sub-programs that was created a few years ago was what we call a small grant program. So for grants up to $400,000, any club, it's a small amount, but, you know, $400,000, yeah. that's quite a bit of money. Any club, any lake association.
Like Ducks Unlimited?
Ducks Unlimited, Rough Grouse Society,
okay.
you know, the county, Soil and Water Conservation District, any sort of legal entity can apply for those funds to do projects. A good example in Coochiching County was the Soil and Water Conservation District applied for some funds to restore a section of a stream. It had degraded by some erosion and some trees falling in. They went in, they cleaned it up. It's a walleye spawn spawning area, so it fit that criteria about habitat. But oftentimes you'll see a community purchase a 40-acre tract because it's it's special, it's unique, it's threatened with development, and they'll keep that as a county park, or they'll donate that as a wildlife management area or something.
So it
like that.
It could go to counties or municipalities.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
So we call it the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant, CPL. It's on our website, and there's an application period. Typically twice a year we'll have two different application periods. All of the proposals come in, and there's typically like 100 or more, get ranked by a review team, and then the ones that come out on top get that funding.
Okay. It's Minnesota's DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr joining us this morning.
I had a question I've wondered, because I live on a lake where there are people with float planes, and they go by a lot.
Yeah.
Are there restrictions? How do they deal with aquatic invasive species?
Well, the same restrictions that apply to boats apply to planes. So they cannot be transporting aquatic invasive species. They should be, if they're going to come off of one lake, they ought not be going directly onto another. They ought to be stopping at an airport, making sure they're not carrying anything. I think, typically when you think of the physics of the pontoons on those things, they don't necessarily have the architecture that would capture those things. They're right. Tended to be sleek and streamlined and air efficient, so they don't tend to have a lot of things hanging out like a boat trailer does. But even so, obviously, if they left a boat in a zebra mussel infested body of water, a pontoon float plane in a body of water with zebra mussels for some period of time, zebra mussels could become attached to that, and if they were then to fly somewhere else, they could be moving those. So they absolutely have to be as cautious of float planes as a boat. And also, the removable docks. We know of at least two lakes that were infested because somebody moved a dock that had zebra mussels from an infested lake to an uninfested lake. And so, we just have to constantly be conscious of that here in Minnesota, because we're a water-rich state, that as you move from one body of water to the next, make sure you're not moving some nasties along with it.
Yeah. We do get to chat with you when you come up to we have a district office here, the DNR in Grand Rapids.
Right.
How many people are employed out of the Grand Rapids area? Do you know?
I don't have a specific number for Grand Rapids. Statewide, we have about 2,700 what we call full-time equivalents. It's a lot of our staff are part-time. They work in the summer at the state parks, for instance. So there's 4,000 different people work for DNR. I think out of Grand Rapids, I'd guess we have about 100 to 120 people.
Bemidji's another regional office too, isn't it? Bemidji.
We have four regional offices: Grand Rapids, Bemidji, New Ulm, and then we've got a regional office in St. Paul too, in addition to our central office.
Okay. Let's touch on Mille Lacs. It's always in the news.
Yeah.
And of course, the walleye management of the walleye population has been real controversial this summer. But what made me think of asking you a question about Mille Lacs was lost, I think, in the discussion of walleyes. Of course, the bass fishing on Mille Lacs is superior to almost everywhere. But do we know what the impact of zebra mussels is having on the lake? That's what made me think of it, is because we were talking about zebra mussels.
My response to that would be, I don't know that we can isolate the effect of just zebra mussels. One of the things we know about Mille Lacs is it has changed over 30 years. And part of that is, for instance, the water clarity has been improving dramatically over 30 years. The water clarity today, is 10 feet versus 30 years ago, it might have been 4 feet. And part of that is the Clean Water Act. In 72, the Clean Water Act came along. All these people that were essentially draining their cabin into the lake now have septic systems. And so the water quality has gotten dramatically better since that time. I believe it was 2008 when zebra mussels were found in Mille Lacs. They have a similar effect. They are filter feeders, so they're cycling this water through and they're pulling out nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, algae, things like that, which has the same effect. That also makes the water more clear. So one of the changes in the lake over 30 years has been that the water is getting clearer, and that can have profound effects. It means that weeds will grow to a deeper depth because now sunlight gets to them. It means that fish have different behaviors because now they're visible, whereas before they weren't. And walleyes are not a light-loving species. They may go deeper as a result of that. And so it's changing on that side. But we also know that the winters are getting shorter. So the ice time on lakes is becoming shorter. And it means the water's warming up. And we know that, you know, many lakes that are cold water support ciscos, you know, tulibees, they support these cold water species. As they warm up, they support different species, and we may lose the tulibees, and we see the smallmouth bass moving into lakes now where they had perhaps not been. And so the lake itself is changing, and that is one of the things that's kind of in the background of our whole management scheme here. But the fundamental problem is that while we are spawning a lot of walleye eggs, while a lot of walleye eggs are hatching and sufficient to provide a strong age class, the baby fish are not growing into adult fish. The survival rate is too low to get what we call a strong age class out of them. And so we have a singular problem that we have limited survival of fish into the catching size. Right now, 2008 was previously had been the last strong year class. The next one was 2013. So we had a five-year period where there was almost no survival of walleye, and now we have one strong year class. It's a 2013 year class. We've not seen any strength in the years since then. We still have some hope for 2016, but that means we've got one. It's like having your fifth grade and nobody else. And so, you know, we have to protect those fifth graders because there's nobody behind them. And so that's the challenge we're in. There's a lot of those fish out there, but they might be the only fish we have to lean on for 10 years.
And raising fingerlings is really expensive, isn't it?
It is expensive. Fingerlings, yeah, you know.
They're not making it either.
They're not making it either. Oh, somewhere between that fingerling stage and 8 inches, they're disappearing. And we know that the adult walleyes are preying on the young walleyes, but you know, if it's a decline in tulibee, which seems to be part of it, if it's and for some reason we aren't seeing perch, we aren't seeing the other forage fish, you know, all that's left is those young walleyes, and so everything that each fish is eating those young walleyes. So a lot of just ecological things going on, and then we've got the backdrop of having to manage in this very stringent system under our co-management with the bands.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else, Heidi?
No, that is our Minnesota DNR Commissioner, Tom Landwehr. You can find lots of information at their website, dnr.state.min.us. You give a different one.
MNDNR.gov.
All right.
Yep.
Yeah. Sounds great. Thanks for stopping by today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And when you go to that website, if you really like the outdoors, be sure you have plenty of time because you'll start wandering around that website to everything you like about wild and natural places.
Yeah, we
Minnesota.
Talked yesterday with your bee specialist, and she was telling us that you can find near you to how to find native plants that would attract bees, and you can find that right on the website as well. So for these conversations yesterday's, this conversation today will also be on our website. You can go to KAXE.org. Up next, we've got National Native News and Laura Erickson speaking for the birds, and we're finding out about Sod House Theater that is coming to Bemidji.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. Hearings continue for the second day in Nebraska, where that state's